Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this Friday, perhaps you are contemplating Boyhood versus Birdman, or Sniper versus Superhero, Mom versus Maniac, and all of the Oscar battles we will look at as we talk about the impending Academy Awards a little later this hour with Rafer and Kristen. We will talk about how Walmart can actually give the nation a raise. We will see how size matters in this part of the economy. And just a warning, later this hour, we will hear how the power of erotic audio is undiminished in the drearily clinical, no-secrets era of online visual pornography. It's perhaps not something for the Sesame Street crowd, but we'll have a completely legal discussion about one of the oldest professions in the electronic age. But I can't resist a flashback to the 70s just for a moment to set up our top story. Nature's waiting, you, something's wrong. One of my favorite bands, Spirit. To say it's nature's way is possibly the best takeaway in describing what is going on right now in hospitals. An outbreak of superbugs, or what are more precisely understood as drug-resistant organisms at the UCLA Medical Center, has infected at least 7 patients, 2 of whom have died. More than 170 others believed to also have been exposed. The infections may have been transmitted through 2 body-probing endoscopes, even though the devices had been sterilized. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria kill at least 23,000 people every year in the United States, infect at least 2 million people annually. Why? Well, you learn that in elementary biology. Bacteria, any organism really, living in a stable environment with a reliable food supply, facing regular cycles of buildup and die-off, will eventually either become extinct or become resistant. This is exactly the situation in hospitals. Persistent growth over many generations in an environment filled with sterilizing chemicals and antibiotics produces bacteria that aren't actually super at all. They are just doing what nature does, evolving and becoming resistant over time. Becoming this.
I remember thinking, she looks bad. This is bad. Something's really, really wrong. They put her on antibiotics. Her blood pressure was dropping. They, were making space in the ICU for her. The next morning, she needed oxygen via mask. They looked at part of her lungs and diagnosed her with pneumonia. I remember sitting there watching the sun come up and thinking, how did she get so sick?
The case of Addie Rarasich was featured in a 2013 Frontline documentary called Hunting the Nightmare Bacteria. As her mother, Tanya, explained to Frontline, her daughter needed a lung transplant in the end and faced years of only partial recovery. Joining us now is Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Frieden, thanks so much for taking time out and joining us today.
Nice to talk with you, John.
So, Doctor, let's first of all talk about how concerning the UCLA incident is in this battle between antibiotics and resistant organisms.
The UCLA situation is really the latest example of what we've been talking about for the past several years, a nightmare bacteria, CRE as it's called, really is scary. It's a type of resistance that spreads between many different types of bacteria. It can resist virtually all of our antibiotics, and the fatality rate can be quite high. So it's a very concerning situation, and it's why we've launched something called Detect and Protect, because we think, in fact, we're confident that it is still possible to control these organisms, difficult as they are to treat.
What did it evolve from? Where did it come from, this bacteria?
We have 2 different types of CRE, as it's called, in this country. One of them is mostly homegrown. The other one was first identified in India. Most of the cases in the U.S. are the homegrown variety. But the challenge is that really doesn't matter where they came from. The fact is they're here. And if we don't do a better job controlling them, they'll be not just in hospitals, but in communities. And that's what has us most concerned.
So right now, the reservoir, as epidemiologists call it, is hospitals. But if it should jump into the population, then we really are facing a disaster scenario. Is that overstating it?
No, that's actually quite correct. We're very concerned about this. I will say that About 2 years ago, my top scientists came to me with exactly that concern. They said, we have to sound the alarm. We have to stop this before it gets out. These are organisms that are resistant to virtually every antibiotic that we have. And currently, they're largely associated with procedures like the endoscopy in the UCLA case, or intensive care units where people are very sick and getting lots of antibiotics. And even in those situations, we've been able to control it in several states, and some countries have done a good job of that. But in the U.S. as a whole, it has spread and spread and now is in at least 44 states. The concern is if it gets out into the community, then routine things like a urinary tract infection or a cut could become life-threatening.
That is pretty scary. And it makes me feel like doing a good job is maybe not sufficient, that you've got to either be absolutely perfect or you're in real, real trouble here. Is it the case that the bacteria may have survived the sterilization procedure in this endoscope? I know they're investigating it, or that it was just improperly sterilized?
It may not be possible to know for sure. We don't think these bacteria are more hardy. It's not as if they're more likely to survive sterilization procedure, but some of the duodenoscopes that are used are very intricate, so it may be quite difficult to get in and clean all of them, and that may be one of the things. But more broadly, what we know about this type of bacteria is that there are things we can do to stop it. We've seen outbreaks controlled in Colorado, in Florida. We've seen the rate of this infection go down in Israel and elsewhere. And that's done by a few key things. Tracking it so we know where it's spreading. Preventing antibiotic resistance by improving the way we use antibiotics and improving prescribing practices. And then making sure that when we do find patients who have this, we protect them and other patients by isolating them and having specific rooms and equipment and staff for patients with those infections, and doing things like getting catheters out as quickly as possible. Those steps can make a big difference. And in fact, the budget that the administration has proposed to Congress has as our number one priority combating antibiotic-resistant bacteria to improve our ability to fight this. And this is the Los Angeles case is an exact example of what we're concerned about and what we want to scale up our ability to find and stop.
Well, let's talk about this administration program here. As you suggest, last September, President Obama called for $1.2 billion in funds to combat and prevent antibiotic resistance, resistant organisms. And basically what he's doing here is basically funding something that the private sector doesn't have a big incentive to fund, because antibiotics are most powerful if they stay on the shelf, not if they're prescribed. And so you've got to get companies to invest in new antibiotics that aren't necessarily going to make a lot of profit. And some doctors were telling me that this $1.2 billion, if it's approved, could be the most important thing the Obama administration does if we look back 100 years from today. Where does that stand right now?
Well, it's up to Congress. The administration has put in its proposal. For CDC, our request is $264 million, and that would allow us to protect the antibiotics we've got more. We would be sending the vast majority of that to states and large cities to scale up things that work to reduce inappropriate antibiotic use. We think we can actually cut the level of CRE, this nightmare bacteria, by 60% over 5 years, based on what we've done in specific areas when we use this detect and protect strategy.
Now, I want to talk about patients and what they can do, because in many ways this is so rudimentary that patients actually do have a role to play here. But let's talk about designers of medical equipment. You described a moment ago that the endoscopes are very intricate, which suggests to me that while that makes a lot of sense because they are sophisticated technology, maybe designers need to be a little more sensitive to shaping devices to make them easier to clean, to not allow for shapes that will allow bacterial growth.
This is something that the Food and Drug Administration is looking at closely. But we have to step back and remember, these are pretty wonderful pieces of equipment that allow very sick people to avoid having surgery. So what they're doing is really going in through an endoscope and doing a very complex procedure that would otherwise require cutting open someone's abdomen and doing a full surgical procedure. So it's not a simple thing to get that design right, but absolutely it's something that needs to be looked at.
What can patients do if they're going into the hospital? My mother was in intensive care a decade ago at the Mayo Clinic, and even they advised going in that we should be standing outside her door with sterilizing fluids to wash everybody's hand who goes in and out, that it was not sufficient for the nursing staff to simply do that if there were visitors.
We do encourage patients to insist that everyone wash their hands before touching you when you're in the hospital. We also think it's very important for you to tell your doctor, nurse practitioner, if you've been hospitalized in another facility or country, and perhaps most importantly, to take antibiotics only as prescribed and to recognize that, like every medication, antibiotics have both benefits and risks, and only take them when they're absolutely necessary. Our studies suggest that between a third and a half of all of the antibiotics used in this country are either completely unnecessary or inappropriately broad-based.
Well, this is such a great discussion. Finally, before we go, this is something that people really need to pay attention to here if we talk about these hospital-borne infections. Is there an extent to which this can be dealt with by regulation? I was looking at the Joint Commission recommendations on these hospital-borne infections, and there's a lot of recommendations that seem pretty soft. It's okay to just target bacteria in high-risk places. There's not a call for a complete sterilization of a hospital facility or a wing.
We have now recommended from CDC that every single hospital in the country have an antimicrobial stewardship program. These are the programs that make sure that antibiotics are being used well by all of the doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners in the hospital, and that we're tracking where there are resistant organisms and what to do about them. And with this kind of activities, particularly if we get the support we've asked for, we think we will be able to turn back the clock on this nightmare bacteria.
Dr. Thomas Frieden is director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
America's biggest private employer announced this week that nearly half its workforce is getting a raise. Walmart will be bumping up the salaries for 500,000 employees, including those at Sam's Club outlets, to at least $9 an hour. Walmart aims to push that to $10 an hour by 2016. And now before you say, big deal, a buck an hour in this economy, and we'd love to hear what you do with that buck an hour in this economy, you can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Before you are skeptical, we're sympathetic to that skepticism, let's look at the unique scale of actually the world's largest employer. Okay, they are third to the U.S. Department of Defense and China's People's Liberation Army, but those other two don't ever have to make a profit. Walmart, folks, is big. What they do affects the rest of the U.S. economy. Danielle Kurtzleben is economics correspondent at Vox.com. Danielle, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
How big is Walmart? What lever do they pull here, and does it really have ripples throughout the economy?
Walmart is huge. I mean, they have around 1.3 million workers, give or take, here in the U.S., so that's just the U.S. And you take that out of the entire U.S. non-farm workforce, and that's around 1% of all U.S. workers. Now, just 1%, when you think about it in another context, might not seem that big, but that's of all people working in the United States. So that's a huge amount. So when Walmart says we're going to take a bunch of those workers and bump up their wages substantially, that's a very big deal. One way of looking at this is you take all of those abstract numbers we get in the jobs report every month. This is a concrete example of those numbers changing. Every month when I look at the jobs report, when any other economics reporter looks at it, one of the big things we're looking at is whether hourly wages are increasing. And the reason we're looking at that is because that's a clear sign that maybe slack is diminishing in the economy, that employers are finally having to bump up wages to compete for workers as opposed to workers purely having to compete for employers. So this is a clear sign of how that number changes.
And looking at the couple of the components here, there's the stimulus component, that money going into the economy. while individually it's not terribly significant, I mean, that does have an effect in disposable income being actually spent at the level of sort of community businesses where Walmarts are, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Walmart has said around 500,000 workers are going to see some sort of a pay raise this year.
And, you know, it is a sign of the tragic income disparity in the United States that at this level of the economy, that money, as I said before, will get spent. It's not going to get saved. It's not going to be put into stocks and bonds like the wealthy can do. But the positive impact of that, it means that it goes directly into the economy. Are other low-wage employers forced to increase wages as well here, at least to think about it?
This is sort of, first of all, a sign that the economy is improving. But then part of it is that Walmart might be saying with this move, listen, we don't want to lose our workers to someone else. We want to bump up our wages. We want to keep our workers where they are. We train them. We want them. We don't want them going to, you know, for example, a competitor like Target or someone else. So you know, you can imagine, and I'm using this purely as an example, you can imagine Target saying, well, geez, we want to keep our workers. We don't want to lose them to Walmart, who is upping their wages. We want to up ours. So it's easy to see how this can sort of create competition for really good workers.
And for all the demoralized workers at that sort of hourly level who are listening to this and wondering how it will have an impact on them, there are plenty of sort of labor initiatives in the retail sector that are trying to bump wages up. Certainly fast food workers are part of this trend. But one of the big watchers of this sector of the economy is the Federal Reserve, which actually, if they see a lot of slack diminishing in the economy and lots more competition for wages, they assume that inflation is possibly on the horizon. Does that change the entire Fed outlook?
I'm going to give this a very qualified yes. I mean, look, the Fed can definitely look at this the way that I was sort of saying I look at this, which is saying this is, once again, a very clear, very big. I mean, let's not diminish this. It's a big example of how wages are increasing in the economy. And I'm sure, no doubt, that, you know, the people on the Federal Open Market Committee are going to look at this and say, yeah, wages are going up. But, you know, if you look at their most recent minutes, they're all very cognizant as well of the fact that, you know, inflation is still pretty subdued. I mean, it's been this long and that they've had interest rates near zero. And inflation just isn't really picking up that much. So, I mean, this could be, a sort of hint that, yeah, inflation could pick up. But I mean, I wouldn't take it too big just yet, just because inflation has been so stubborn. I don't know if this is the sort of move that signals or triggers that it's really lifting off.
And one of the reasons, and it's something that you and others have written about, is that employers, including Walmart, have gotten really good at staggering hours, at reducing overtime, and creating other kinds of efficiencies that, even though you're raising wages on the hourly side, the net cost may not increase so much because you can play a lot of games with the scheduling of workers since 2009.
Right, yeah. And there's one big thing called just-in-time scheduling. I think that sounds like a bit of what you're hinting at here, which is employers like Walmart, like McDonald's, you know, that employ a lot of hourly workers, a lot of shift workers, can really sort of bump your hours around, make them, you know, a lot smaller, make them a little more erratic, based purely on when your computer scheduling system knows that people are going to come in or thinks they will come in. And yeah, that has made a lot of worker shifts a lot, as I said, a lot more erratic over the years. It's not the straight up 9-to-5 shift that people might have pulled 20 years ago.
Danielle Kirchleben is the economics correspondent at Vox.com, talking about the Walmart raise for 500,000 hourly employees. Danielle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato.
I understand what you're saying, and your comments are valuable, but I'm going to ignore your advice.
Honey, this is only the beginning.
Stick with me, and we'll claw our way to the top.
Hey, weren't you on TV last night?
Yes, I was.
How would it suit you to be famous again?
I know it will please you, you conceited devil.
Does it please you that this is the Friday before the Oscars and we have the Movie Date team? Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer here. Movie Date podcast co-host Rafer Guzman is also film critic for Newsday, and Kristen is also culture producer for The Takeaway. Hello, folks.
Woohoo! Happy Oscars.
Hi, John.
So, what does this Oscar field signify to the both of you culturally? I think it's an interesting bunch of choices. Rafer?
I'm pretty excited because I think two of the most inventive and audacious films of the year are both the front runner for Best Picture, Boyhood and Birdman. You know, I don't think you could ask for two more interesting and unusual films.
And if you throw, Budapest Hotel in there, you've got very interesting filmmaking contending for Best Picture. Kristen, what do you think?
I think, let's just get this out there right now. I think Birdman is very overrated, and I think the industry loves a movie about itself. And why it is tied for the most nods this year with 9, not quite sure. But I will say, if I was going to categorize this year's nominees in any way, I would point out the fact that all of the Best Picture nominees in total have grossed very little money, the lowest in years.
But that's always the case, though.
Well, not as much as this year. These are major indies that are happening this year.
All right. So isn't the Oscars, though, all about overrating everything in advance of the statues?
I will give that to you, John.
All right. Very good. Very good. Okay. What do you think? Do you think Birdman's going to win or Boyhood, Kristen?
I think Boyhood's going to win. And frankly, I think Boyhood deserves to win. I think it's a bigger accomplishment. This took 12 years to make. We're checking in every year with this family, telling a story that's pretty ordinary, but in a way that has never been done before. I just thought it was an incredible accomplishment.
Will people be wearing T-shirts at the Oscars, do you think, Rafer, over the Selma snubs or the potential Selma snub?
I kind of doubt that. I think it's all kind of a done deal at this point. But I do think that's important to point out. I really think David Oyelowo, who plays Martin Luther King in Selma, should have at least gotten a Best Actor nomination. And I think Ava DuVernay, who directed it, should have gotten a director nomination as well.
And there are other performances that I think are extraordinarily memorable that probably have no chance. What would you rate, Kristen?
Oh, my gosh. There were so many movies I just loved this year that nobody was even going to notice. I loved the movie In Secret, which was an indie with Oscar Isaac in it. I loved Belle that has Gugu Mbatha-Raw and all these little indie movies. I already said earlier it's a big indie year, but these other indies that are even smaller didn't get all the love that I wish they would have.
What are performances that were nominated that you think will get noticed but probably not an award this year?
Rafer, I know that you were gunning for Benedict Cumberbatch at one point winning, weren't you?
Well, I wasn't gunning for him. I just thought he seemed like the obvious choice. And it's a very good role. And his movie, The Imitation Game, had done a lot better than The Theory of Everything at the box office. Everyone loves Benedict Cumberbatch. But then Eddie Redmayne won for playing Stephen Hawking at the Golden Globe. He won the SAG, and now it looks like he's a sure bet for the Best Actor Oscar.
Really? Even over Keaton?
Yes, I think so. I think a lot of people have a feeling that Keaton is going to win just because there's been so much talk about Birdman, but I really would be amazed if Keaton won. I think it's Redmayne's Oscar.
I absolutely agree. And I think Redmayne is just, I mean, the accomplishment of this role is unbelievable.
Is.
He can barely use one quarter of his face to play the role, and yet he's somehow playing this role in a convincing, amazing way that he's a fully forged person.
The Best Actress category is a real conundrum, it seems to me, Kristen. How have you resolved this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Julianne Moore in Still Alice is unbelievable. She's playing somebody who is dealing with early onset Alzheimer's in a really unbelievable, convincing way. And yet, I don't think a lot of people saw Still Alice. I think she's going to get it for it. But if there's any upset at all, which it's doubtful, but if there is, I think it'll be Felicity Jones for The Theory of Everything, playing Jane Wilde, the wife of the wife in The Theory of Everything.
Would this be Julianne's My Left Foot, or is this a Lifetime Achievement Award Oscar kind of, sort of?
I think it's a My Left Foot one. It's a really incredible job that she does in this film. She really brings you along for it where you feel what she's feeling.
Rafer?
I don't think it's a My Left Foot performance. I just think it happens to be the strongest performance in kind of a weak category. Not that these actresses themselves are weak. I just think all their roles are a little underwhelming. And I think Julianne Moore's role just allowed her to do the most with what she has.
Best director for Birdman, that's a no-brainer. Kristen?
No, I think it's going to Linklater,
really?
Actually, for Boyhood.
Right.
And I mean, don't get me wrong. Birdman, as much as I make fun of it and say it's overrated, it really is an unusual looking film.
It's a director's movie.
It looks like it was done in a single take. And that's unbelievable for a feature length film to look like that.
That'll give him cinematography, though, right?
Possibly. But I mean, really, I think that when it comes to directing, it's going to be Boyhood for sure.
All right. Rafer, what do you think is the importance of the two supporting actor roles?
Well, I think these are both going to actors that have been around for a long time. Patricia Arquette for Boyhood, and she's marvelous in it. Kind of a role that you don't realize is really great until the movie wraps up and ends, and she delivers this terrific speech at the end, and you really realize what an important thing she's been to that movie. And then J.K. Simmons for Whiplash. Kristen and I are huge Whiplash supporters. He's great. He plays an abusive music teacher. He steals the show. He's terrific. Been around for years, and I think it's great that he's going to get the Oscar for this. And I think both of those actors, by the way, are absolute locks for these categories. They're both definitely going to win.
And these are also who you think deserves it, right, Kristen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I do need to point out while we're talking about supporting roles here, Robert Duvall being nominated for Best Supporting Actor for The Judge, which is not even a good movie and not even the best of Robert Duvall, that's like a legacy nomination. And as you said,
that's lifetime achievement.
You said earlier, John, a lot of these people are just, you know, really celebrating themselves, and it's a bunch of hoo-ha, and, you know, this is a legacy thing. And so I really wish Robert Duvall had not been nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
He probably wishes it, too. He doesn't want the camera on him. He probably doesn't want to even go there. I'm sure he doesn't want. So what other sort of issue sense? I mean, the documentaries this year are also really, really interesting and very, very current. Rafer, in the last couple of seconds?
I mean, I think obviously just by default, if anything else, it's going to go to Citizen Four, the Laura Poitras movie. I mean, I think everyone was really impressed by that. I thought it was okay, but I think the Oscar is definitely going to go to that.
Podcast preview, Kristen?
Oh, this week's podcast, we're actually going to be talking about the new releases that are out this week, most notably The Duff, which I'll just play our hand right now. Rafer and I loved. We thought The Duff was one of the smartest teen comedies to come out in years and just hilarious, really good fun. And we think people of all ages, not just teenagers, will love The Duff.
Possibly a setup for the 2016 Academy Awards. Well, stay tuned for the 2015 Academy Awards. Will you be live blogging or anything?
Yes, we'll be live tweeting it, and we'll even be playing some Oscars bingo with the other folks here at WNYC.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend. May the best actors and actresses win. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
One of the silly commentaries following the release of the $200 million box office blockbuster 50 Shades of Grey is that perhaps there was less on screen than you might have thought if you just listened to the movie.
It's just beyond this door.
What is?
My playroom.
Yes, many of the reviews of this curious softcore phenom said it left too much to the imagination. That's the problem with the visually erotic. It's about no imagination. See everything to the point of being pretty grim. At least that's what I've heard, right? Well, for the next few minutes, a discussion of where this isn't a problem. Erotic audio. And I say this now as a warning for some of you who will turn this off in the company of impressionable kids, etc. Go ahead. Others, I suppose, will want to turn it up. To hear how Nona Willis Aronowitz, a writer for Playboy magazine, explored the history of audio porn, something which didn't really exist before recorded sound.
I actually started looking into this. I was thinking, okay, I found some stuff going back to the 1960s, and then I found a ton of modern stuff, but when did this actually start?
Now, you may also want to turn down the volume or turn it up to hear our other guest, 40-year-old Raven Fox, who makes her living as an online erotic audio performer. In her experience, visual just can't compete with audio porn.
When the cues you get are strictly auditory, your imagination fills in the exact details that you need. So if you want to go nasty and tawdry, that's fine. You can go there. If you want a more romantic, soft, PG-13 scene, then that's where your imagination is going to take you. It's theater of the mind. I'm sort of like the director.
So we have a custom track from you, Raven. And can you tell me the circumstances of this? It's for someone named Jack.
Oh, yes. He had gone through a nasty divorce, a really serious breakup. He'd had some other trauma going on, and he was basically just going to give up on love. So, and he wanted it to be encouraging, but with some sexual aspects to it.
So how about you let me take care of you? I'll show you what I had in mind. I could just keep kissing you.
I just improv that. I just sat down. I didn't have a script and came up with what I would want to tell him. So it was first we were flirting and then we had sex and then we're doing the pillow talk afterwards. And I'm telling him that, you know, love is out there for him. and not to give up on love.
Raven there is cutting edge today erotic audio. Nona Willis-Aronowitz takes us back way before 8-track.
I went down a rabbit hole of from one historian to the other, not knowing anything about this. And finally, I talked to the right person, and they told me that pretty much since the phonograph was invented, people have been using it for pornographic means.
She sat there holding a tit. I said, well, you'll never learn to milk that way. Now you better squeeze on it or do something or other. She says, well, I will when it gets ready. I said, well, what are you waiting for? She says, why, I'm waiting for it to get hard.
And these kinds of tracks would be in a phonograph in bars, and barflies would just listen to it through listening tubes sort of one at a time for a nickel. And I don't know if you were really supposed to be titillated in the same way that Raven's clients are because you're in public, but porn has always sort of had that humorous element to it, and it definitely started with that.
How much can you get paid for this, Raven?
Well, I support my family with it. My standard story, which is they send me an idea and I run with it. It lasts about 20 to 30 minutes, and it's personalized to exactly what they want, and that starts at $60. And it goes up with the complication of the story. If it's a complicated plot, a long script, if they want two voices.
So you can do two voices?
Yes, because I have a really sweet and cute voice that I can use. And some people really like this one, but it sounds nothing like my actual voice. So I can record two different tracks and mix them, and it sounds like two people having a conversation. I have so many people that have said, who is that other person?
Now, in the interest of journalism, of course, I mean, how freaky does this get?
Well, that depends on your definition of freaky.
Right, of course.
Are there limits
to what you won't?
There are my personal limits. Yes,
What are those?
Nothing with kids. Mm-hmm. Nothing with animals, and no potty play.
But you know, if you want that, it's definitely out there.
Oh, it definitely is out there. Yes.
My, you've had an interesting 5 months, haven't you?
Yes, I've really gone down the rabbit hole. I mean, you know, I saw everything from rape fantasies to quote unquote age play to incest to all kinds of creative scenarios that probably would be a lot more, if not disturbing, then maybe thorny if you were watching it. But since it's only audio, you can really imagine what you need to imagine.
So what do you think the culture of audio porn is? I mean, on some level, if you talk about this for a while, of course. I mean, I guess anything has its sort of pornographic aspect. But was there something that you discovered in this world of audio porn that was surprising or different than the sort of overall porn world?
Yeah, I think the through line is that people wanted as real of an experience as possible. I mean, the paradox of what Raven is talking about when she says that it's all pretend, it's all fantasy, that's true, but it also feels really real and really immediate and immersive. It's this combination of sort of low-grade exhibitionism, but it's totally safe and it's really personal. And I also think people are sort of wanting to break away the fourth wall a little bit. I saw this on Reddit, and I also saw this with other people that I interviewed from earlier decades, that people feel free to communicate with each other. They become friends. They request things. They comment on each other's tracks, and it's all very personal. It's a curated experience.
Are there different styles, Raven? Is there like a, you know, public radio version or a kind of Wild West version or, you know?
Well, we actually have on GWA, we have a couple of actual sexy stories. There was a series about actually NPR.
It's a series that someone proposed. They posted scripts of various public radio personalities.
Oh, really?
John, I'll have to see if you're on there. I don't know.
Oh, my God.
But
who's on there?
Oh, Ira Glass and what's the guy from Prairie Home Companion?
Oh, yeah, Garrison Keillor.
Garrison Keillor.
This is Garrison Keillor from the Prairie Home Companion. I was at the Lake Wobegon adult bookstore one hot summer night, picking up a copy of Prairie Girls Gone Wild, when I noticed a young man in front of me in ripped denim jeans holding a shopping basket filled to the brim with merchandise, a copy of Blue Boy magazine, a fistful of lubricants, which must have been invented by NASA for masturbating.
All right. Yeah, I think we get the idea. Poor Garrison, man.
I think he should take it as the highest compliment.
I'm sure he will. Yeah. Well, that's pretty wild. Please check if I'm on there, and if I am, there's a delete probably key on your.
You know about Rule 34.
What's Rule 34?
Whatever is out there, there's porn of it.
Ah.
That is Rule 34. So.
With that thought, thanks so much, Raven.
Thank you for having me.
Raven Fox is the online persona of a erotic audio performer. She supports her family, selling personalized audio on her website. Nono Willis Aronowitz is a writer and editor at Talking Points Memo. She recently wrote about the history of audio porn for Playboy. Nono, thanks so much.
Thanks.
On Monday, you can hear about a diversity that can only be described as human. That's a quote from writer Mohsin Hamid, who talks about his unknowable Pakistan, all its kinks and twists, from the man who taught us all how to get filthy rich in Rising Asia. Send us your kinks and twists. Be the takeaway by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.